You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the last few billion years, a staggering array of life forms have come and gone on planet Earth. Sometimes certain species have merely been outcompeted by others and disappeared. At other times, massive disasters drove nearly all life on the planet to the brink of oblivion. It seems that one of the constants is that catastrophe could be right around the corner. In her latest book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, New Yorker staff writer Elizabeth Kolberg traces the history of mass extinctions, including one that's happening right now, which we are causing. It is published by Henry Holt, and I'm very pleased that it brings Elizabeth Kolberg back to our show. Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How much of the planet's surface has been transformed by human activity?
Something like 50% of the planet at this point has been, you know, sort of directly transformed by humans. But on some level, I guess you could argue, there's pretty much no corner of the planet that hasn't been touched by humans at this point.
And we are changing many of the planet's ecosystems along the way?
Well, our impact is really, you know, ubiquitous. I mean, if you know what you're looking for, you could go anywhere and find it. And one of the sort of ironies of, or paradoxes, I guess, of writing this book was I went out with scientists to these really amazing places, the Great Barrier Reef, 12,000-foot high peak in the Andes, the Amazon rainforest. And everywhere we were going, we were looking at human impacts, even though, you know, it seemed like we were sort of as far as you could get from humans.
A few names have been suggested for this particular era that humans are causing on the planet, including Anthropocene, the Homo Geocene or Gocene, I'm not sure, and my favorite, Catastrophozoic. Is there one you prefer?
Yeah, those are there. Well, there's also a great term that a Canadian marine biologist came up with, the Mixocene, I believe it's pronounced. And it's from the Greek word meaning slime. And his point there was that we're turning the oceans into a realm that is going to be only, you know, sort of inhabited by invertebrates, or an age of jellyfish.
Well, we have these names for the past ones, but why bother giving this one a name if we may not survive it?
Well, it's actually a really fascinating sort of scientific project, and it really makes you look at the world in a new way, which I think is sort of the point of it. And the term Anthropocene or Anthropocene, depending on if you're a Brit or an American, they're pronounced differently, was first sort of popularized by a Dutch chemist named Paul Crutzen, who was one of the people who realized that what we were doing to the atmosphere was creating, you know, what we know as the ozone hole. So he won a Nobel Prize for that. He's a very, very smart guy. And he told me this story that he was sitting at a meeting one day, and people kept referring to the Holocene. We officially live in the Holocene. That's about the 12,000 years since the last ice age. And he said, forget it. We don't live in the Holocene anymore. We live in the Anthropocene. And everybody sort of was slack-jawed. And these are a bunch of scientists. Everyone came up to him afterwards and said, that is such an incredible idea. And it really just shifts the way you think. We are become the dominant force on the planet. And that term just has really taken off.
And what does it mean when we go back to the original? Is it Latin or Greek?
Well, seen, I think, is actually, it's a really weird term, but Charles Lyell came up with these terms over 150 years ago, the Eocene, the Miocene, and they were sort of, they're Greek, they're things scrunched together, and Holocene means the wholly recent time. So I guess Anthropocene sort of means people recent. It's a pretty weird term.
Now, isn't the idea of extinction a fairly new one? Mass extinction even newer?
Well, extinction and mass extinction are sort of contemporaneous. And interestingly enough, when extinction and the concept of extinction was first introduced back in the very, very early 1800s, the inventor, if you will, of that concept, a French naturalist named Georges Cuvier, he thought that all extinctions had occurred in these massive bursts, and sort of understand how innovative his idea was, even though it was not entirely correct. You have to go back into the 1700s when the concept of extinction didn't really exist. And people were finding, you know, as the Europeans colonized the New World, they were finding all sorts of really interesting bones, mastodon bones in the U.S., giant sloth bones that came from South America.
And they assumed that they were still around. We just weren't seeing them.
Exactly. And that and when Thomas Jefferson, you know, sent Lewis and Clark to the West, he expected to find mastodons out there. He refused to believe in the concept of extinction. And he, even though he kept a whole fossil collection in the White House. So then Cuvier comes along and says, well, if these, I mean, it's not, we wouldn't consider it really, really sophisticated science these days. It was just basically logic. He said, well, if a mastodon were out there, you know, we would have seen it by now.
They're pretty big.
Exactly.
So he came up with the idea that the mastodon must have died in some kind of a mass extinction. And he lived before Darwin. But it seems his discoveries would have led him to think about evolution.
Yeah, it's a really interesting moment and somewhat forgotten. I have to confess I'm not sure exactly why, because Cuvier was a really towering figure in his day. Even to the British, he was considered the world's leading naturalist. But then there was a lot of tension between the British and the French, and the British have sort of written scientific history ever since. And
so we don't talk about Cuvier, we only talk about Darwin.
Exactly. So Cuvier was sort of discredited. Because of his, he really resisted evolution. Lamarck, I'm sure many listeners have heard of, Lamarck was a contemporary of Cuvier, and he believed in this sort of vaguely, what we would consider sort of vaguely mystical form of evolution, where animals sort of adjusted to new circumstances and passed on these adjustments to their descendants.
Giraffes want to eat the leaves on the top of trees so their necks get longer.
Exactly, exactly. And ducks, you know, had to dive and they got webbed feet, and moles went underground and got small eyes. Exactly. That sort of evolution. He called it, was called transformism in Paris at the time. And Cuvier was his main rival, scientific rival, and he thought that was ridiculous. Animals couldn't, you know, just changed themselves when they wanted to, and he really he delivered Lamarck's eulogy, and it's a wonderful, wonderful thing to read if you like a really, really nasty insult.
And that's the eulogy. Was Darwin aware of the notion that humans could cause some extinctions when he was writing Origins of the Species?
It's actually really interesting. He alludes to it very briefly. He talks about extinction. He says, we know that animals become rare before they become extinct. That is what we've seen in the case of human extinction, human, you know, induced extinction. And then he just drops it. But it's pretty interesting because his theory sort of demanded that extinction occur through competition, that it occur very slowly. So it's this sort of interesting little tiny inconsistency.
And that's despite the fact that many tortoises on the Galapagos Islands were wiped out by visiting sailors, almost instantaneously.
Yes, and Darwin was aware of that. He went to this island, which was a really, it's now called Floriana, and he met a Brit who was there as the governor who was running a penal colony there. This guy told him the tortoises on all the different islands are different. They have different shapes, shells, and the tortoise on our island is disappearing.
My guest is Elizabeth Colbert. Her latest book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. You write about the demise of the great auk, which is kind of like a penguin or...
Yeah, it was called a penguin originally. I sort of called that chapter the original penguin, and there's a lot of confusion because it's a flightless bird.
It went extinct during Darwin's lifetime.
Yes, absolutely. And it was, you could have found them, you know, up and down the coast of North America and all across Europe at one time if you'd arrived at the right time. But they were flightless, and flightless birds are very, very vulnerable.
When did we come to think that there might be two things that cause extinction, that Darwin might be right and Cuvier as well?
Well, that really occurred, this really interesting shift occurred only very recently, maybe in the 1980s, the theory that the dinosaurs had been done in very suddenly by an asteroid impact.
But what would suddenly have meant? A year or a million years?
Well, I think if you can imagine an asteroid impact, which now sort of theory goes sort of broiled the surface, entire surface of the planet. You can imagine that that happened pretty quickly. But the fact of the matter is that when you're looking back that far, so about 66 million years, you can't really distinguish, you can't resolve time between, you know, a day, a year, a thousand years. And at the point of a million years, it didn't take a million years, let's put it that way.
You note that over the course of writing this book, one species you observed went extinct and three or four others have gone extinct in the wild. How many species might disappear this year?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. I mean, one of the problems that we have sort of getting numbers like that is we don't know how many species are out there. So what we tend to do to look at, say, extinction rates, you know, is we look at groups that we know very well, like amphibians or mammals.
Is there a normal extinction rate? Because we've seen lots of extinctions even during my lifetime. Some of them just seem to be they lost their habitat. Well, right now we're seeing butterflies go through a serious problem because they're losing their habitat.
Right. And one of the points that I hope comes through in the book is that you shouldn't be able to see any species go extinct. There is something called the background extinction rate, and that is basically what Darwin was talking about, that, you know, eventually species are going to be outcompeted, something else is going to come in and sort of take their niche. But that is usually, if we look back at the fossil record, a very unusual process. So, for example, people have tried to figure out for mammals, how often should you see a mammal go extinct? And it's only once every several hundred years.
Evidence points to climate change and changing carbon dioxide levels as causing the Ordovician extinction half a billion years ago. Do we know what caused the massive shift in greenhouse gases at that time?
You know, these things are sort of like solving a cold case that's 450 million years old. So one theory is that it was just this way in which all the land masses sort of migrated to the bottom of the world, what's now Antarctica, that maybe caused this cold snap that seems to have caused that extinction. But that is very speculative.
What did life on the planet look like before that happened?
Well, that is very interesting because that life was still confined to the water at that point. There was very little living on land. So that was devastating. This Ordovician extinction was devastating for life in the water.
Because the chemistry of the oceans changed? Is because of the carbon dioxide?
Well, this was actually sort of the reverse of what we're doing now. It was sort of a drawdown of carbon dioxide from the air. It was a cold snap. And we don't really, as I say, we don't really know why. But it was a freeze event, and so, you know, all the consequences happened that you can imagine from sudden glaciation.
Jumping ahead a few hundred million years, the Permian extinction was also caused by a change in greenhouse gases, but in the opposite direction.
Yes, exactly, and that is unfortunately much more analogous to what we are doing by pouring a lot of CO2 into the atmosphere really quickly, and the Permian extinction, which did in something like 90% of all of the species on the planet, is the worst of all of the mass extinctions of the last half billion years.
There are theories that warming oceans favored bacteria, which produced hydrogen sulfide. So in effect, the planet became filled with toxic air?
Yes, and people have sort of speculated what the planet would have looked like, and it's a really eerie picture of a green sky and a purple sea.
Could that happen again today?
I don't think anyone's anticipating it, you know, in the near future. But if the mechanism for the end Permian extinction was massive CO2 and we continue to massively emit CO2, I guess you can't rule it out. How's that?
Elizabeth Kohlberg's book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, is published by Henry Holt. We will continue our conversation. There's a lot more extinctions to go, aren't there, Elizabeth?
So we're just getting started.
We will find out about some other extinctions and how these mechanisms work right after we take a little break. Stay with us. Elizabeth Kohlberg is a staff writer at The New Yorker, author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change. And now, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, is published by Henry Holt. We've been talking about different extinctions. The last one was the Permian. Do scientists point to these extinctions and say, look, we know that changing carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere can lead to disaster because it's already happened twice?
Well, that is one of the things that they point to, yes, absolutely. But I think more broadly speaking, they would say, look at these moments when the planet changes, you know, really dramatically and really quickly. We seem to get these results where a lot of species just can't adapt fast enough. And we, people, right now, I mean, precisely the reason we're in this situation is that we are changing the world on a globally, radically, and very quickly.
And often it's the oceans that wind up showing the effect, as happened with the impact after the asteroid hit that killed the dinosaurs. It also had a major impact on the ocean's called, it's been called the Strangelove Ocean.
Right.
Stanley Kubrick.
Exactly.
Did he know about that?
Yeah. It was, he would have enjoyed it. He probably did know about it. The ocean, you know, just everything in the ocean seems to have sort of almost shut down for millions of years.
Well, why does it happen to the oceans?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I guess the short answer is we're not entirely sure, but one theory about what happened in that last extinction at the end of the Cretaceous period, the asteroid impact, is that the asteroid impact hit the Yucatan Peninsula, and one theory is that released a lot of sulfates, which are sort of the same things that get released when you get a volcanic eruption, and that changed the chemistry of the oceans.
Is there a sort of gallows humor among scientists who study mass extinction, even when they're talking about the possibility of it happening to us or our grandchildren, that they would call it the Strangelove Ocean?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. There's a kind of a and when you think about it, there's nothing more appropriate than, you know, honoring Dr. Strangelove and the incredibly dark humor, you know, of that movie.
How was the fact that there was an asteroid that hit the Yucatan even discovered and then linked to the extinction of the dinosaurs?
Well, it's a really fascinating story, and it's the story of a scientist named Walter Alvarez and his father, Luis Alvarez, who was a Nobel Prize-winning physicist. And what happened was Walter Alvarez was looking for something totally different, and he came across in Italy this layer of clay where it seemed like something weird had happened. And he decided, everyone knew this was, you know, roughly the time when the dinosaurs had become extinct, but he decided he wanted to know exactly how long that had taken, that clay layer had taken to get formed. And he took it back, and his dad got this idea that they were going to measure iridium layers. And iridium is an element that's very rare on Earth and very common in space. And what happened, to make a sort of long story short, is they found that the iridium layers in this clay were astronomical, to use the word, and they couldn't figure out why at the beginning. And then they batted around a lot of different theories, and then they came up with this idea, well, it must have been an asteroid impact. And this is all pulverized asteroid dust that we're looking at, basically.
Going all the way from the Yucatan to Italy and
exactly.
Probably and everywhere else.
Exactly. And they went and they looked. They looked around the world and they found it in a couple other places. And then they proposed, you know, by putting two and two together, as it were, that this is what had done in the dinosaurs. And it was resisted very, very strongly until they found a crater. They went looking, okay, if there's a huge asteroid, and this was an asteroid, you know, the size of Manhattan, roughly, where it should have left a trace. And in fact, it did. They found it in the Gulf of Mexico by looking at these sort of gravity surveys that the Mexican oil company had done. But it took a long time to find it. But now it's pretty widely accepted that that is the crater from that asteroid.
So what would be the result of this current situation if humans follow the rest of the world's animals and plants into extinction? What will that layer be?
Well, that, you know, that's a really also really interesting question. And in one of the chapters of the book, I go out with a geologist who's very interested in this question. Have we entered, you know, this new geological time, the Anthropocene?
And if we did, it would be the only one that humans actually caused.
Well, the only one that a species of animal caused, right? Humans haven't been around very long, so, you know, we're just getting started on some level. But that's precisely what they're trying to do, you know, sort of the geology of the future. And he has taken this imaginative journey, you know, many millions of years into the future and tried to think, okay, what is it going to look like when everything that we've built, everything has been, you know, collapsed into this, you know, layer of sediment that's roughly, you know, the thickness of a cigarette paper, he writes. And there are a lot of ways in which our presence will be noted. For example, this big spike in carbon emissions, that will be something that will be recorded in the rocks.
There'll also be a thin layer of plastic?
Yes. I mean, you know,
Will the cockroaches be the ones that survive, as we've often said, or will it be some other species?
Well, his theory, you know, and I'm only offering his theory, and it's offered somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but I would say not entirely tongue-in-cheek, is that it's going to be the rats. And rats are everywhere now. They are on islands, very remote islands, that had no native mammals whatsoever. And he makes the point that we know that animals can change size pretty quickly, and they'll be giant rats.
Well, you have a chapter called The New Pangaea, is it, or Pangaea? I never know. And that is about invasive species, rats being just one. Snakes in Guam, another major example. We have invasive species everywhere.
Oh, absolutely. There was just a piece, I'm sure, you know, many people read it just the other day, on zebra mussels, which are an invader from Eastern Europe. They've just taken over waterways around here, and they are looking desperately. Someone had come up with a sort of bacteria that he thought might be able to fight them. But invasive species are everywhere. Are the pigeons in New York are essentially an invasive species?
Well, in some cases, the invasive species are killing off indigenous species. But can we say that humans are an invasive species? Are we the reason that bats are now suffering from this white nose syndrome?
Well, I quote a science writer who points out that humans are the most successful invasive species on the planet. We live everywhere, you know, virtually everywhere on the planet now, and in every sort of habitat. And humans almost certainly brought over, probably from Europe, this fungus that is causing white nose syndrome.
And we've killed off a number of species. Are we responsible for the disappearance of the American mastodon?
The most recent research suggests, yes, we are responsible. And the theory there is that, you know, humans, mastodons, all these very large animals, there's something called the megafauna extinction, and it occurred when humans hit new continents, Australia, North America, South America. And I think the most recent thinking is that, you know, these are very slow to reproduce animals, and you don't have to put a lot of pressure on their numbers to eventually bring them all the way down to zero.
But did humans also get rid of the other hominids, the Neanderthals and the Denisovans?
Once again, that appears to be the case if you look at the archaeological record. Wherever humans got, whenever they got to a part of Europe, the Neanderthals only lived in Europe. Whenever humans got to that part of Europe, the Neanderthals pretty quickly disappeared. Interestingly, though, we interbred with the Neanderthals and the Denisovans. So that is a pretty fascinating and amazing discovery that's just been made recently.
But have we escaped natural selective pressures on our species?
That's another really interesting question.
I try to ask the interesting ones.
Yes, you have. You've hit on a lot of them. You know, there is this way in which we do not depend on evolution, right? If we want to do something, we don't sort of wait to evolve, you know, a new claw or a tougher fang, a longer fang. We just go out and make a tool. So our relationship to evolution is, you know, probably unique in the history of life.
Well, the mastodons disappeared, the woolly mammoths disappeared, but African and Asian elephants survive, although right now they are endangered. Why did they survive when the others didn't?
Well, one theory is that people came from Africa. That's not just a theory. That's, once again, very widely accepted, that modern humans evolved in Africa. And one theory of why Africa still has more of its large fauna than other continents is that they co-evolved. So early humans and elephants co-evolved and elephants sort of learned how to protect themselves from humans. And then when humans reached a new continent like Australia, which they reached very early, 50,000 years ago, the native fauna had no experience with this new thing. this hominid and was done in pretty quickly.
Although we still have kangaroos and koalas and a few other things. The Tasmanian devil is gone, and that's only, again, within the last couple hundred years.
Well, we do have, you know, there are a lot of wonderful creatures still left in Australia, but the Australian fauna has been devastated, the native fauna, and continues to be devastated.
My guest is Elizabeth Colbert. Her latest book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. You begin the book by looking at the disappearing golden frog in Panama. Of the over 7,000 species of amphibian, how many are currently threatened?
Well, amphibians have the unfortunate distinction of being the most threatened class of organism on the planet right now, and 40% are classified as threatened.
Every kind of frog, mostly, but also newts and other things like
well,
that?
Well, yeah, amphibians have three. There are three kinds of amphibians. One is the group that includes frogs and toads, and one is salamanders, and one is these weird limbless creatures known as Sicilians, I believe you pronounce it.
They're among the oldest animals that live on the surface.
Yes.
On Earth. And I would assume that they play a role in keeping the Earth in balance as part of the ecosystem, just as the bees do, and we're seeing the disappearance of bees.
Well, a lot of people are looking at that, you know, that question as like frogs in the tropics are really disappearing at a really alarming rate. In one of the chapters, as you mentioned, I go to this part of Panama that was home to this beautiful animal called the Panamanian golden frog. And that was also a disease that swept through, doubtless transported by humans. And now those frogs only exist in captivity. And people are trying to look at exactly that question. What effects does that have on the rest of the ecosystem? It's not easy for us as humans. You know, we're not down there sort of in the soil figuring out exactly, you know, how many insects those frogs ate and what the cascading effects are of that on these other creatures. But people are looking at that.
Well, frogs eat flies, and they keep fly populations in check. I can easily foresee suddenly an infestation of flies, the sort of thing that happened in biblical times. You mentioned that you visited coral reefs, and you call them organic paradoxes. What do you mean by that?
Well, coral reefs are really interesting and amazing, and everyone's seen pictures of them, but how they function is kind of extraordinary. There are these a coral is a little animal, a tiny little gelatinous creature, and they secrete this very, very tough substance that becomes the reef, right? Everyone knows that reefs are hard, so you have these little gelatinous creature constructing these huge, towering, very tough structures.
Late in the book, you ask, does it have to end this way? In some regards, I have the feeling that our fate is already sealed. Have we already reached the tipping point?
Well, I think the answer to that is that we don't know, and we kind of have to act in a way that we try to protect, you know, as much of the natural world that's still out there. I don't think that, you know, unfortunately, when you're in the midst of a pretty big event, you don't really know where exactly you are along it. Some scientists would argue, for example, that, you know, we still have time to prevent, you know, this mass extinction, but we need to act pretty quickly.
Well, getting back to the coral reefs, we do see them disappearing and under serious attack. What would happen if they pretty much disappeared?
Yes, as you say, coral reefs are under really massive threat. The Great Barrier Reef, which I visited, which is an amazing place, has lost about 50% of its coral cover just in the last couple of decades. And if they disappear, if reefs disappear, and unfortunately there are predictions that they could be the first major ecosystem to just functionally disappear, then, you know, on some level it's a big question mark. We don't know how many species live on them and absolutely depend on them, but one can sort of infer, especially if you're looking down at the reef and seeing the incredible richness, you know, of life there, that a lot of species are going to be in trouble.
You visited a frozen zoo where scientists are keeping cells of certain animals alive. Is the hope that someday we may be able to recreate species which are likely to perish in the short terms? And going a little further, there's an article in the New York Times today about attempts to bring back extinct species like the American passenger pigeon.
Yeah, those are all sort of, you know, those have a wonderful sci-fi aspect to them.
And de-extinction.
Exactly. And they're, you know, they're very, they're not at all implausible. I mean, it's not implausible given the incredible advances being made in genetics that we could do that. But the question you have to ask yourself, and in the case of the passenger pigeon, it's a pretty severe question. I mean, why did this bird disappear? Where would it go? Passenger pigeons existed in flocks of, you know, a billion birds or more. If you could somehow, you know, genetically engineer a couple, presumably they'd just be living in a cage somewhere. And is that really the future that we want?
Or do we want to bring back mastodons and set them free in upper New York State?
Well, that's also another very interesting idea.
If we drive a plant or animal to extinction, do we have a responsibility to try to return it to the planet, or should we just accept the fact that it's gone forever?
Well, I think that the question is really more where do we want to be putting our energies, you know, and resources? And I guess I'm going to side with those who would say, let's put our energy and resources to preventing species from going extinct in the first place, as opposed to the massive resources that it takes to bring the passenger pigeon back, if it's even possible. That's not an easy thing to do. So let's focus on not letting them go extinct.
Well, you're right. And I'm quoting you, if you want to think about why humans are so dangerous to other species, you can picture a poacher in Africa carrying an AK-47 or a logger in the Amazon gripping an axe, or better still, you can picture yourself holding a book in your lap. Do you think that many of us try to avoid thinking about our personal responsibilities for what's happening to the planet?
Well, in that part of the book, I was really trying to convey to people that, you know, it's not just humanity's what we would generally consider our bad qualities that unfortunately lead to extinctions. It's also our good qualities. We're very social. We're very cooperative. We have massive societies. We pass on this technological knowledge. And the net result of all that is that we are capable of changing the planet.
Well, we also are caught in this terrible paradox. I'm sure that for much of your travels and researching this, you flew in airplanes, and airplanes are incredibly destructive.
Absolutely, in more ways than one. I mean, we're not just talking about, you know, our carbon emissions. In the case of international travel, one of the points is that we bring together species that haven't, you know, we bring in something on our shoe. The bat disease probably came in with some tourist who had no intention of bringing that over.
And things were on ships that the rats spread all over the world because they were on ships as they reached each different port. You note that extinction may be the first scientific idea that kids have to grapple with. Kids generally are fascinated by dinosaurs, so do you think that they're going to get it, even if we haven't gotten it completely? And people in Congress still seem to not get it?
I don't know. I mean, kids are, and they're very attracted to, you know, that's why you see campaigns for pandas and polar bears and animals that are very kid-friendly, because kids really do relate to animals in a way that we as adults unfortunately don't.
If you're a fan of Elizabeth Colbert and want to see her, be sure to go to the American Museum of Natural History tonight at 6:30, where she will be in conversation with Michael Novacek, the great dinosaur man, who's been a guest on our show a number of times. For ticket information, go to our show page at WNYC.org. Her book is The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, and it is published by Henry Holt. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks for having me.